And you know, it's quite okay if you're meditating and if you fall asleep. There's nothing wrong with a good yawn. The problem is that when people come into like a, say, a Buddhist temple, they think, wow, I mustn't yawn, I mustn't fall asleep, that is not allowed. But that creates a lot of tightness and tension in you. Many times, one of the problems in our modern world is called sleep deficit. We don't sleep enough. In our temple in Perth, we have these rules in Theravada, the Thai tradition. It's also in many other Buddhist traditions, never to point your feet at the Buddha statue. And never to be so disrespectful to go to sleep during your master's discourse or meditation. But one day, this woman came in when I was teaching meditation. As soon as she came in after 5 minutes of the half an hour meditation session, she lay down on the floor with her feet towards the Buddha statue, fell fast asleep and started snoring. And a couple of the people around her woke her up. And when I saw that, I gave the talk on, don't do things like that ever again, waking her up. Because the woman had actually talked to me just beforehand that she was one of these victims of domestic abuse. She was afraid to go to sleep in her house in case she might get assaulted. You might think, why don't they go to see the sociologist or the psychologist or the police or the authorities? Easy enough to say, but when you're in that situation, you don't think it's the way you would think of an ordinary person is not being in such stressful situations. And so she came to the temple. It was the first time in weeks she felt safe and protected. So she lay down and just fell asleep because that's what she needed most of all. And I told people that. So after that experience, when people fall asleep during meditation, if anyone has a cushion, they put it under their head. If they had a blanket, they tuck them in. Have a nice sleep during the Dhamma talk. Because what is the Dhamma talk trying to teach people? To be kind and ordinary acts of kindness and celebrating those. We can't always be really wonderful meditators and sit dead straight for half an hour or an hour. We can't always be wise. Sometimes we make mistakes. We can't always be experts. In fact, half of the people in this room will be below average. Which ones are they? Or not me, the one next to me. But sometimes we just try too hard to be someone we're not. At times we can't do things. We don't know how to let go and just to be. That simile of the guitar string, or you could call it a violin string. Stretched and stretched and stretched, which is what you have to do for a guitar string. And sometimes that's your life, being pulled apart, stretched to try and do what life expects of you, what you have to do, what people tell you you should be doing. And that's why this thing, resilience, we're so tight, bing, 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 which means small things make you very upset. I remember the story of the road rage in New York. And there was two drivers, I don't know who was at fault, they were so angry at each other that one of them was chasing the other and managed to catch up at a big intersection at a red light. And so one of the drivers jumped out of his car, went round to the other car, was banging on the window, trying to break it, trying to get at the other driver he was really angry at. And of course, that other driver was terrified what might happen. The driver who had the road rage, who jumped out of his car, was like some demon, some monster. He was crazy, he was mad. But the traffic lights changed in time. And so the fellow could actually drive off before his window was broken. And the other fellow, still mad, turned around to get into his car. His car had gone. In his anger, he'd left his door open, keys in the ignition with the engine running, and a street kid had taken the opportunity to get into that car and drive off. So this person who had road rage was up there standing in the middle of an intersection, seeing the object of his rage just drive off, and he lost his car. There's something karmically appropriate in that simile. And that's what happened. These true stories, which I remember because they're funny, and say, don't do things like that. You think you're getting angry, but this is what happens. So you always lose out. And it's because that driver was just so tense. I don't know what's happening in his life, struggling and striving and pushing themselves so much. And a small thing, bing, their guitar string made a really high note. But when you're really relaxed, then life, it hits you, disappointments happen, sicknesses, stress, you're so relaxed. There's no tension in your head at all, no sound. That's called resilience. And that's one of the reasons why simple things like taking time and not striving so hard lower your expectations. We have high expectations of ourselves. We have high expectations of our Prime Minister. Come on, you should lower your expectations of that by now. But because of our high expectations, we really get upset. We should know better by now. But that was that executive once who came up to me, and she said that all her life she was struggling and striving. This is where she was. This is where she knew she could be. But she could never actually get up there to where she knew she should be in life. With all her abilities. He said that was causing me so much pain and stress. He said the solution is so obvious. This is where you are, where you want to be, this is where you are. How about lowering where you want to be to where you are? Contentment. And you find that you're an ordinary person, but you can celebrate that and enjoy. No stress. I teach a lot of people in Singapore, wherever, some big groups, and oh, they're such high achievers. And sometimes they come and ask, should I take that promotion? I say, of course not. So why not? Look, think about it. You'll get more money. Maybe twice as much money, but twice as much stress, which means your life will probably be halved because of heart attacks and sickness. And you'll probably have to pay all the extra in hospital bills and you can't enjoy your life. And anyway, no matter how much you earn, it's never enough. Look at Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, whoever these amazing multi-billionaires are. Can they go on retreat? Take a week off? No. They're workaholics. After all, I can't believe it. How much money has, say, Bill Gates got? Why does he have to work? He should be putting his feet up and relaxing. But no, they still have to work, make more money. How many billions do you need? Anyway, so they always say, actually, for those. I think the London School of Economics did this research. I read it many years ago because I was a scientist before, a mathematician. So they wanted to work out just how much money, what salary, what income for a single person to earn so they are comfortable. Because it's well known, too much money, and actually what happens, you get too much stress. They've got to invest it, which means, because you've got surplus money, you've got to invest it, you've got to find out which company is going to do well, stock markets and goodness knows what else, you've got to make sure it's ethical investments, it's not going to harm the environment, and you know, many people come and ask you for donations and stuff, and it's family especially, if you're in times of difficulty, if you've got too much money, it's too much stress, and they worked that out. It was like a curve, there was an optimum income. And more than that, actually, you started to suffer. And I don't know exactly what the income was, but what is the average income in the US, in London?
No, but it was about 30,000,
35. Yeah, £35,000.
And after that, it didn't make any difference to your happiness.
Yeah, okay. So anyway, if there's anyone here earning more than 35,000, you're going to have a lot of suffering. And Venerable Chanda's Anukampa Bhikkhuni project can actually help you increase your suffering by taking some of your donations. I've told that story many times, it never worked. But it was worth a try. But it's just, no, just keep yourself ordinary. And celebrate the orderliness. Who are you trying to prove? Even having big houses. This story was actually reached. I read it in a newspaper in Australia. There was a woman who won the lottery in England. And it's £41 million sterling. Would you like to have £41 million sterling? Stupid. People say that, share with everybody, but they never do. So anyway, what she wanted to do first of all, her dream was build a mansion in Sussex. So she got this huge mansion in Sussex, and she sold it after 1 year at a loss and bought the equivalent of a two up, two down in a little village. You know, the two up, two down, two rooms downstairs, like a small house. And the friends actually asked her, and it was published in the newspaper, why did you do that? And the article was titled, that, "Honey, I can't find my kids." Because what had happened in a huge mansion with so many rooms. She was in one part of the house. With so many rooms, the kids were in another part of the house. Husband was in another part of the house. And she hardly ever saw them. The house was splitting up her family, dividing the people she loved through not seeing one another. That's why she bought a small house, so she could see her husband, see the kids many times during the day. And I thought just how wonderful that was. The tiny houses, the small apartments, where people actually can't get away from one another. I'm not sure about you, but you know, I was brought up in a council flat in Acton, the poor part of Acton. The school I went to was called Derwent Water. Its real name was Dirty Water School, that's what we called it. And there's lots of migrants there from Africa, many from Poland. I remember one of them, Jerzy Sahaki. Anyway, all these, I thought that was normal. But it was a sign, it was from a poor neighbourhood. And so, in a small council flat, you could never sort of escape your mum and dad. You could never, I had to share a room with my brother for 18 years of my life. And we'd fight. There's nowhere to run to. I learned how to love. My brother, sharing a room for so many years, he became a banker. I became a monk. Almost opposite ends of the spectrum. And you'd think that, you know, just we wouldn't get on. But you'd seen us together, and we would love each other. And just last day of the trip, I'd spend a day with him. And, you know, my nephews and nieces and stuff. But you know what the nephews call me and nieces call me? Instead of like, you know, uncle, that's, you know, that's for an ordinary person. They call me Munkle. And Venerable Chandra's nieces and nephews call her Nunty. Not auntie, but Nunty. That's true, isn't it? Yes. So it's a wonderful thing. And I often, why did that happen? And it was because we couldn't escape one another. We had to learn how to love. And one of the problems of our modern world, even in London, one son has their own room, a daughter has their own room. It separates the people we love, which means we don't learn the social skills of loving one another, accommodating one another. And later on in life, it leads to trying to find a partner in life. We get divorced, we separate. If you grow up knowing you can't separate because you're in the same room together, you're fine. We only get on together. And I saw my mother and father fight many times. No, just not hitting one another, but shouting at one another. And when they had an argument like that, actually I was looking forward to what happened next. Because they couldn't escape from one another, so they had to make up. And they couldn't avoid the kids. So my brother and I always saw it. Saw them make up and apologize and kiss and express their love together. And that's one of the things I learned. That arguments, differences of opinion, are normal, natural, they're ordinary. But making up afterwards, kissing, saying sorry, that was extraordinary. And that came with this wonderful feeling that doesn't matter how much we differ, that's to be expected in life. There's something which is more important. Once upon a time, there was this couple who'd just been married. And this is a story I tell on every marriage blessing which I do. And when they were married, a few days later, they're having a walk after lunch in a nice park, when they heard this sound. Quack, quack. Quack, quack. Whenever you give a talk, it's very useful to do animal imitations or do something to draw people's attention. Quack, quack. And then the wife said, "Oh, darling, can you hear that? That's a chicken." He said, "Did you say chicken?" He said, "That was a chicken." "Darling, that's not a chicken. That is a duck." She said, "No, no, 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 no. I heard it. That is certainly a chicken." He said, "It can't be. It went quack, quack. Chickens don't go quack, quack. That was a duck."
They went quack, quack again. There you go, it's a duck. She said, no, it's a chicken. It's a duck. No, it's a chicken, I'm sure. It's a duck. D-U-C-K. Duck. And at that point, she started to tear up. It's a chicken. And he looked in her eyes and remembered why he married her. He squeezed her hand gently. He said, darling, you know, I think you may be right. That is a chicken. It went quack, quack again. Yeah, it's a chicken. I get it now. He said, thank you, darling. And they carried on their walk in happiness and peace. Now, in that story, I change it around every now and again. Who says what? In that story, the man was a smart fella. For two reasons. First of all, who cares whether it's a chicken or a duck? Is that worth having an argument with the people you love? Is it? Of course not. He understood priorities. What's more important, love or an argument? Or being right? And how many times in your relationships, how many times do you have these stupid arguments on stupid things just because you have to be right? You know, there's nothing wrong with being wrong. So, first of all, he was smart because he had his priorities right. Number two, just because it goes quack, quack, does not necessarily mean it's a duck. When I first told this story, I said it could be a chicken from Fukushima nuclear disaster zone who's been mutated by the excessive radiation to go quack, quack. That was a long shot. But of course, having told that story, people go on the internet and they found out, yeah, there are chickens who actually go quack, quack. They found one because, true, I have the article, but it's over in Australia. That little orphan chick was brought up by a duck and being adopted in the family. And now it goes quack, quack. It's a chicken, real chicken. It goes quack, quack. That could have been the one. So all this time you think you may be right. Who knows? You know, it can be wrong. But it was, the best thing was, of course, that they understood what was right. Oh, we were doing a fundraiser in Perth once, and this Malaysian girl came up to me and said, "We'll stop whatever we're doing this afternoon because we want to help you raise funds for your nuns' monastery, or whatever we were building over there at the time." And I said, "Oh, thank you very much." And no, this is my chance to say thank you to you. Because I'd done the marriage blessing for her maybe about 6 months before. And the first months of her marriage, she got very frustrated with her husband. Because every time they had a discussion on things which really matter in their marriage, the husband would just stand there and smile. Whenever, you know, she wanted to discuss something, he just would not participate. And it frustrated her so much. One day she said, "Look, why aren't you saying anything about the important issues of our relationship together? You know, why aren't you speaking?" And he just looked at her and said the two words, "Quack, quack." And she really remembered then the advice I gave her when they first got married, that the love was more important than having these arguments, which he sensed would actually be divisive. And she said they haven't had an argument since. They could discuss things, but not in an argument. Amazing, it's wonderful, I'm so pleased about that. But anyway, we always expect too much of ourselves and of each other. Our priorities of contentment and peace and compassion aren't met. And somebody reminded me of one of their favourite stories, which I told them. Again, these are all real stories. I was like, chicken and duck, I made that up. But, you know, it's real, that marriage which saved their marriage worked. But this was a time when I was a school teacher. I was a school teacher before I became a monk, over in Devon, in King's School, Ottery, St. Mary, and teaching physics and maths and stuff. And at the end of the year, actually that was one of the reasons I became a monk, after teaching teenagers. I was losing my hair anyway, so. No, I enjoyed being a monk. So anyway, that I had to set the end of the year exam. I had to give out the results. You know, in those days, everyone was graded. And as my class of 30, one child came 30th. One child has to come 30th. If you had a class of Einsteins and Stephen Hawkins and Roger Penrose's geniuses, someone has to come 30th, the last. Doesn't mean they're dumb. But when I gave out the results, I saw this was a boy. He got his results, bottom of the class. He never expected it. So you saw him look and look down, his shoulders slumped. You could see the telltale signs of depression in a 14-year-old. You could read his mind. You need to have psychic powers. What am I going to tell my friends? They're going to call me dummy. What am I going to tell my parents? They're going to take away all my privileges, so I have to work harder. No more video games, no more going to football matches. Study is more important. The poor fellow was so upset. And they knew I was a Buddhist even then at school. That was 1973. And even then, you know what I did once? You had to do the school assemblies. I don't know if they still do those these days. And so the principal asked me, yeah, you do the school assembly this week. Can I do whatever I want? I said, yeah. And so I did meditation. 73. 650 kids coming in to school. They didn't know what to expect. I said, I'm going to teach you meditation today. And so all sitting down on the floor of the assembly hall. Okay, just cross your legs, which they all did. Sort of straight backs, and it was like this, like a Mexican wavy thing. So all the kids straighten their backs. Chins down, close your eyes. And I led them through 5 minutes of breath meditation. And every one of those kids was quiet. Then afterwards, I said, now it's time to come out of meditation. And this is true, it's really impressive. At the end of that, they gave me an ovation. Every one of the kids started clapping. They'd never done anything like meditation before. In 73, way before it was introduced in schools. And they felt something, which was a wonderful thing. And one of the teachers afterwards told me, what would happen if one of the kids, say the 11-year-olds, it was a dual-gender school, what if one of the kids started laughing, didn't cooperate? And that's when I came out in a sweat, because I knew if one kid wasn't silent, you'd have lost the whole class, the whole 650 kids. But I never expected that. So of course it never happened. That's another interesting part of psychology. What you're afraid of, you make happen. If you don't think it's going to happen, it usually doesn't. The mind is the forerunner of all things. The mind, if it thinks something's going to happen, you make it happen, most of the time. So anyway, so at the end of the year, that this poor kid came bottom of the class. And I'm a compassionate man. I'm not going to let anyone just suffer like that and just leave him alone. I've got to help him. So I went up to him and I looked at him and said, you came bottom of the class. Yes, sir. He was very depressed. He said, well done. I said, I'm going to teach you, then you're a Buddhist. I'm going to teach you the idea of the Bodhisattva. A Bodhisattva is a being who sacrifices their own happiness and well-being for others. He said, I know that you could have done much better, so I assume that you've deliberately, on purpose, chosen to take this terrible position of 30th in the class, out of compassion for your friends, so they don't have to suffer what you're going to get tonight from your parents. You've done this on purpose, you are. Everyone else in the class just thinks of themselves and is so proud and egocentric and conceited, but you stand out, you sacrificed yourself on purpose for the sake of the happiness of your friends. So after this class is finished, I'm going to take you to the principal. I'm going to suggest, ask the principal to give you the Bodhisattva of the Year prize in this school. The one who sacrifices their own happiness so that others don't have to suffer. And he looked at me like I was the craziest teacher he'd ever had in his life. And then we both laughed together. And I thought that was great emotional intelligence. What's wrong with coming? But I didn't actually remind him, for the sake of any of your children who get this message, that it's a great sacrifice to come bottom of the class in school. I told him, but you're only allowed to get the Bodhisattva prize once in your school year. Next year, let somebody else come bottom. But the little things like that, to celebrate the ordinary, to actually look at stuff and, if you only celebrate what the world says is success, what the world says is the best, the champions, only one person can become a champion. You know, sometimes, I used to follow soccer when I was young. Unfortunately, my father took me to one of the bad teams. I always lost. That was anyone here knows in West London, Fulham. They always get relegated and they lose. And so that's one of the reasons I became a monk. I couldn't stand the suffering anymore. But then sometimes people see all these World Cups and Cricket World Cups. And does anyone follow cricket here? Most frankly, okay. You know, I was almost performed treason for Australia. Australia love their cricket, but so does Sri Lanka. You know what I did once? The Australian cricket team were playing Australia in Perth, you know, my hometown. And it was like a one-day international. And the lunch interval, like at the half-time, the Sri Lankan team were doing terribly. And out of desperation, they asked, are there any good monks, because a lot of them were Buddhist, are there any good Buddhist monks close by? And of course, I said, Ajahn Brahm, he's a really good monk. I said, okay, can you ask what they call this pirit thread? This is this little white string which people wrap around their hands to give them good luck. Have you got any pirit thread here? You got some? No, around here? No, okay. But anyway, so they asked for some pirit thread for good luck. So I know my cricket, so I'm very happy to actually make and bless 12 pieces of this pirit thread. Because they have 11 people on the pitch, always the 12th man. So I got one piece of them. And I sent it to the cricket ground. You know what happened? The Sri Lankan team lost. But that was not important, because that was a warm-up for the World Cup cricket tournament. Actually, you had a World Cup cricket tournament in England recently, didn't you? Yes. Yeah, okay, so you know what I'm talking about. So this was the World Cup cricket tournament, and so I forgot about it. But in that cricket tournament, Sri Lanka did very well. And the final match was between Sri Lanka and Australia. And every Sri Lankan knows they won. Sri Lanka won. Oh, it was the first major tournament Sri Lanka had ever won in its existence. And there were celebrations on the streets. And even in Perth, I saw the photograph of the captain, I still remember his name, Arjuna Ranatunga, holding up the World Cup. Celebrations throughout the whole island. And then I saw, oh my goodness, what have I done? There was my string on his wrist. And the whole team were having my string, which I had blessed, which was the cause of Australia losing the World Cup. If they'd have found out, I would have been deported, put in prison for treason. But it was actually good that sort of, you know, big teams sometimes lose, and that's a wonderful. But anyway, the ordinary things of life is where we can actually celebrate this. I say you lose. Well, I just like a good game. The last game of soccer I ever played in my life was when half-time, our side was about 6-7-0 up. And I asked my captain, oh, that's right, only 9 of the other side turned up. And so I asked my captain, can I go on the other side for the second half to make a game of it? And he swore at me. Winning was more important to him. And I just lost all my interest in competitive sports from that time on. It's not being a winner. Who wants to be a winner? But who wants to have lots of friends? Even at school, even when I was a teacher, you know, sometimes this school system really needs to be looked at. I had to sit next to my best friend and compete with him. I really, 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 really wanted to help him. That's what friends are for, to cooperate, to look after one another. I wanted to pass him the answer to the question. And teacher said, no, that's cheating. He said, it's not cheating, it's cooperation. It's love. Teacher didn't get it. But isn't that the case? We compete far too much, cooperate too little, which is why we have all the arguments later on in life. Liberals, Labours, whatever it is, always Tories, always arguing to be right is the most important. We don't know how to cooperate anymore. So celebrating the ordinary in life, we don't sort of celebrate high ideals or being winners or being in power. We celebrate cooperation and just the simple things in life which cause beauty in life. Instead of going for the big prizes, the ordinary prizes of life are the ones where we find the most joy and happiness. One of my favourite poets was William Blake. And one of his phrases, which I've mentioned so many times, but every time I mention this, you can always see a new angle in it. It goes, to see a world in a grain of sand, see a heaven in a wildflower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, an eternity in an hour. I know my talk is supposed to last an hour, but I hope it doesn't feel an eternity for you. What he meant was to see timelessness, eternity, in the small things of life, in the ordinary things of life. And of course, what does it mean to see a world in a grain of sand? Have you ever picked up a grain of sand and just held it in front of you and just seen its shape, seen what's happening in there? As a monk who does lots of meditation, had many, many, many weird experiences on this. One of the first times was when, just on a meditation retreat in Cambridge, 1970 would have been, we were allowed to go for a walk, a bit of exercise, before breakfast for 1 hour. And because I was studying up there, I knew the area, so I went straight to the botanical gardens. You know, I thought they were open at that time, could have a nice exercise, a nice walk. But every day, except for one, every day I got to the gate And at the gate, I was struck by this beautiful strand of bamboo. Any of you know who know Chinese watercolours? They always feature lots of bamboo. Because there's something beautiful and slender and refined in them. Just, you know, they bend under their own weight. They taper very gracefully to a point. And their colours, they're not strong. They're very, very subdued, as you would expect in a Chinese watercolour. They give a sense of calm and serenity and perfection. And even the way their leaves, just like the bamboo, just thick in the beginning, but they taper gently to a point. And I saw this clump of bamboo, and I wondered why I've never appreciated it before. And I was standing there, enjoying this beautiful clump of bamboo. But I had enough presence of mind to say, if someone saw me, just looking there with gaping mouth, not moving, they'd have called the ambulance to take me away, because it's not the sort of thing a British person would do. So, there was a bench there which I sat down on. I just looked for the 50 minutes. It was only because I was hungry and needed my breakfast that I left it. But I went back there the next day. I went back there for about 8 days out of the 9, to actually just to look at this most beautiful clump of bamboo I'd ever seen in my life, and I never finished with it. I delighted in it for just every day, and then the retreat was over. So back to studies, back to socialising, rushing around, but I had a free afternoon. And when I had that free afternoon, I got on my bicycle and thought, I'm going to go up to my most beautiful clump of bamboo and admire it again. And when I got to that beautiful clump of bamboo, where was it? There was an old clump of bamboo there. Dry, dusty, because bamboo doesn't grow well in the open air in a cold place like Cambridge. And I thought, where's it gone? I could not see its beauty anymore. And the reason was because I'd been too busy. My mind has lost its appreciation of the ordinary. And that made me really interested in just the joy and how to celebrate ordinary stuff. We miss it too much. But the most amazing experience in finding how to celebrate and find beauty in such ordinary things, it was actually way worse than ordinary, because I was on a retreat, teaching retreats at my retreat centre in Perth, getting some really nice meditations, blissing out, enjoying everything. But even if you're meditating, if you're a monk, you still have to go to the toilet. So I went to the toilet to do what they call a number two. You all know what a number two is? Okay, good. So I went to the toilet and did a number two. But then I made my big mistake. I decided to have a look. Wow! Never in my life had I seen such a beautiful piece of feces. Now why are you doubting that? Have you ever really looked and admired it? You know, it was the way those little balls were actually glued, stuck together. You know, it was sort of something which I'd expected to see in a Tate gallery. Some sculptures, what like a Michelangelo could actually visualize. And there it was, floating in the bottom of this bowl. Next. The browns. It's not just one colour of brown. Check it out the next time you see it. There's the darker browns, the lighter browns, and just the way those different shades of browns interacted. You know, it was an artistic masterpiece. And now we haven't even got on yet to the aroma. There's so many fake aromas these days. You know, like lavender, or rosemary. But you know, that's that's like fake and it's superficial. This was earthy, basic. And it was something that was almost like fundamental, you know, there, but people never realize just how it just filled your nostrils with a sensation. And I was looking in there going, wow, this is incredible, this is amazing. That was the most artistic, beautiful turd I've ever seen in my life. And honestly, I did contemplate at the time picking it up and showing my friends. And it was only because of one thing, that I knew how to let go. Training all my life in letting go. It was a tough one, I must admit, it really challenged me. So put your finger in the little button on the top. No, I can't do it. You have to. Oh no, do I have to? And finally I did it. Pressed it. And the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen coming out of my body disappeared out of my life forever. Grief. But that was true. Believe it or not. And that really showed me just how what we see, what we celebrate, totally conditioned, brainwashed, this is beautiful, this is not beautiful. And when your mind becomes peaceful and still, you see beauty in a wild flower. Tiny thing, you see something you never expected before. Amazing what you see. What's the use of that? Spent a lot of time in prisons teaching rapists, thieves, murderers. What many people in the world, please excuse me, would call a piece of shit. I look much deeper than that. See the beauty in them. And that is transforming. To see someone who's done a terrible crime and realize they're not a criminal. They're a person who's done a crime. From that time on, all those years, been teaching, talking with people who've done some of the most terrible crimes, even to convince them they're not a criminal, they're a person who's done a crime. They're much bigger than that. To see people who've got exhibit called schizophrenic. You tell them you're not schizophrenic. You're a person, a being, who sometimes exhibits the symptoms of schizophrenia. You're much bigger than the label they've given you. So you see, I gave that little anecdote, that story, when I was teaching at the 50th anniversary of the Institute of Mental Health in Singapore. I really get to do some really interesting gigs as a monk. You know, things which are actually one of the gigs, I have to accept it, I haven't actually signed off on it yet, was a ghost busting conference in Australia. Real Ghostbusters conference. You know, I know ghosts, but I don't bust them. Just, you know, we like them. We sometimes, if in the wrong place, we've got to chase them out. Just like one of the monks. It was in Kuala Lumpur. There was a house close to his temple which was really haunted. Yeah, really haunted. So he did the thing and just got rid of the ghost. But the problem was, true story, you can't make these stories up. They're just too weird. My imagination doesn't flow that far. He got rid of the ghost in the house, but what the ghost did, it just moved next door. And so he had to, the neighbour complained. Mm-hmm. So he had to do the chant and the ceremony in every house in the street, mm-hmm, to make sure the ghost didn't just move next door, but that stupid ghost actually got out of the neighbourhood. So, but anyway, that's some nice ghost busting stories. But anyway, I've done these nice gigs, and this time was with the Institute of Mental Health. And I told the story. And this gentleman came up afterwards. He was an Anglican, He was a professor at one of the units in the Institute of Mental Health. I said, what are you a professor of? He said, I'm the head of the schizophrenia unit. He said, can you please come and bless my unit? But you're a Christian, I'm a Buddhist. Why are you inviting me there? And he said, because of your talk. So what part did you like? The part about seeing beauty where you never expected, see beyond the labels, to see a world in a grain of sand, a heaven in a wild flower. Qualities which should be there. And I said, how do you treat schizophrenia in Singapore? You're the professor, the boss, the head. And he replied, so memorably, it really hit me. He said, I do not treat schizophrenia in a schizophrenic unit of Singapore Mental Health Complex. I treat the other part of the patient, the part which isn't schizophrenic. Sadhu, sadhu. It was like, at last somebody understands. What's your result? Far better than conventional treatments. You call a person a schizophrenic. You expect schizophrenic behavior. You reinforce that. You treat the other part of them, and you find, this fellow found, the schizophrenia episodes decreased. Look at a prisoner in jail, you call them a rapist. Their possibility of reoffending is increased. You see another part of them, they see it in themselves. And they get what we call a bit of self-respect, enough to give forgiveness to themselves, or even some sort of healing. They can come out from there, from those jails, really a reformed person, seeing things differently. They never ever need to do those terrible things ever again. And it works, in my experience. So this is actually how to celebrate the ordinary opens up to seeing things you never expected in another person. All of you who have problems in your relationship, what time is it? Okay, Q&A soon. Have problems in relationship, you see your partner. What do you see in your partner? If you see past negativity, that's what they'll show you again and again and again. If you see something else in your partner, the reason why you committed to them, their goodness, their kindness, see that. See beyond the things which really irritate you. And that's what they'll show you more and more and more. See kindness in whoever you have to meet. Look for the kindness and you'll find it. Look for their faults and you'll find that. Last little story. That's one of my favorite ones. It became the first in my first book. And that was the two bad bricks on the wall. Many of you know that one. I had to build my own monastery. Couldn't afford to get bricklayers, so I had to learn how to lay bricks. I thought it was easy. But when I finished the wall, two bricks were crooked. So what did I do? I wanted to blow it up, start again. You got a partner, causes you grief. Get a new one. That's what many people do. Blow it up, change it, so try again. So for me, we couldn't afford to get a new wall. I was stuck with it. I was embarrassed. I really suffered. Until somebody came up to me and said, look, that's a beautiful wall. I said, are you crazy? Are you mad? Are you blind? Have you left your glasses in the car? Can't you see those two bad bricks? They said, yes, but I can also see the 998 good bricks, perfect bricks. I couldn't see that before. All I could see is the faults. All a person can see is a schizophrenic behaviour in one of your relations. All you can see is the untrustworthiness in your partner. All you can see is the anger in that road race driver. There's more to them than that. There's more to you than that. Much more. I need someone to point it out to me. 998 good things. They were there. As human beings, they're usually pretty good people, believe it or not. And you're a human being. Therefore, you are pretty good. You belong. And number two is that once you see that, that's what people show you more and more. That's what I saw in that wall. I started to see the good things. And finally, in the cancer group, this builder said, oh, bricklayers make mistakes like that. But in the building industry, he said, when they make a mistake like that, we tell our client, it's a feature. Many of the features you see in your houses started off as mistakes. They made it unique. There's no other wall like that in the world. And they charge you an extra couple of $1,000 or pounds. So that's actually how we can celebrate the ordinary. And the ordinary includes mistakes.